And we have David Morris in the studio. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. You are a part-time local resident of Point Reyes Station, although the rumor is you're actually moving here full-time at some point. You are also, I believe, the founder of the Institute of Local Self-Reliance. Is that?
Yes, the founder, co-founder.
Co-founder.
Of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. That's exactly right. 43 years old in May.
43 years old. So, you know, out here in West Marin, the conversation around localization is very trendy and popular, whether it's locavores for food or local energy supplies. But 74, that wasn't so much the case back then. I'm just curious, how, you know, what prompted you to create this organization? How did it sort of come together back way back when?
Well, there were a lot of threads, but essentially what we realized was that cities had authority. They had significant authority, and that it was the government closest to the people, and therefore it could speak to people with relatively little overhead. If you wanted to run for office, you didn't need $1 million or $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other aspect of it was that technology was, we thought, becoming decentralist in its orientation. This is the early 1970s, and so we were sort of coming out of that 100, 150-year period of shifting from wood to steel, which means from small to big, shifting from water power to fossil fuels, which meant more concentrated, shifting from batch processing to mass assembly, you know, production. So we were literally the technologies that were driving the scale of our economic system and our corporations. And by the early 70s, we perceived a pattern where we were going to move in the other direction. And it's 2017, and that's not controversial any longer. But, you know, you can begin to think of a city actually producing real wealth internal to its borders, whether it's renewables and solar or whether it's desktop manufacturing, you know, and the like. So those were the different threads that came together. But it was 1974, and in 1974, the federal government was pouring money into cities and states. The cities were doing, for the most part, relatively well. There were cities like Detroit and Cleveland that were beginning to lose population, but it wasn't a crisis at that point. And environmentalists hated cities.
Really?
Absolutely. You talk to environmentalists in 1974, and they thought it was a blot on the planet. And that we should all, you know, live in sort of self-sufficient communities and, you know, and the like. So it was an interesting time to essentially talk about decentralization.
Right. Now, was the energy crisis sort of part of this as well, or not really?
Yes, it was one of the precipitating events. This was 1974, and so the oil price increase went up by almost 400% in late 1973, and the federal government did a blueprint, a Project Independence, and they looked at every possible technology. It was thousands and thousands of pages, which, by the way, when Ronald Reagan came in, he threw away. But those of us who saved it, and looking through it, it was pretty clear that solar was the decentralist, a possible future. And just serendipitously, the first terrestrial manufacturer of solar cells set up 20 miles from the Institute 4 months before the Institute for Local Self-Reliance was born. So we got to go and visit Joseph Lindmayr, a physicist, Hungarian refugee who founded the company. We got to go out there and look at the very primitive way in which they were making solar cells and let him say, well, you see how primitive this all is? If we could automate it, the price would come down considerably. So yes, the energy crisis was a precipitating event, in part because it showed us what the dangers of dependence were, and in part because it was catalyzing a possible new decentralist technology future.
Now, where you based? Is it Minneapolis, Minnesota, or where is the?
Well, we started in Washington, D.C.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes, And one of the other factors was that for people who don't know, Washington, D.C., after the Civil War, gave up its independence, essentially. It was not an independent city after that. And it was ruled by three commissioners who were appointed by mostly Southern congressmen.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1964, 64, I believe it was, 62, by congressional amendment, the citizens of the District of Columbia got the right to vote for president. And in 1968, they got the right to vote for the school board. Mm-hmm. And in 1972, they got the right to vote for city council and mayor. And so we were there at that moment where this city was sort of becoming a state and a self-governing body. And so it was sort of interesting to see what might be able to be done in the District of Columbia. And so we focused on the district for the first few years and then realized that it was odd to talk about local self-reliance in a city that ran on everybody else's money.
Good point. Good point. But so where is the Institute then based today? Is it still in D.C.? I thought it was Minneapolis. For some reason, I have Minnesota in my mind.
It's in D.C., but the largest office is in Minneapolis now. And then we have a small office in Portland, Maine.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, that's interesting about solar. It's amazing what's happened with solar. And I suppose in some ways, you know, so when I started writing about energy was in the 80s, I guess. And I remember at the time I was writing for a publication with East Coast editors and they kept going, "You're coming up with these stories about solar and wind in California. That's just a California thing." You know, that was kind of their perception. Or the other thing was, you know, solar's great, but it's the most expensive resource. You know, that was the other thing. Even among environmentalists who were saying, you know, in some ways arguing bigger is better. You know, we need to do because solar is small, but it's expensive. Are you surprised? It doesn't sound like you probably are. What's happened with solar? It's like every forecast about how cheap it would become has basically been wrong, kind of underestimating how fast the price would come down. Are you surprised by what's happened, or probably not? Or I'm not sure what you're going to say.
Our first publication of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance was a publication called The Dawning of Solar Cells.
Okay.
That was 1975. Mm-hmm. A little premature, if you will. The thing about solar cells is that they've always had a non-subsidized market, which is the remote market, and they can compete with batteries. They can compete with having to send helicopters in and replenish the gasoline or the diesel fuel supply. So they've always had a market.
True.
And they began to be put on vacation homes and second homes in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And 1999 is when there were more installations of solar that were grid-connected than were non-grid connected.
Right.
And then in 2006, 2007, when China came in, there was that moment in which the price just collapsed. So I would say that we were probably premature. But one of the things that we preach in local self-reliance is that a city should think of itself as a nation. Not autarkic, not self-sufficient. Nations are not autarkic and self-sufficient, but self-conscious and self-reliant, and that it should track the flow of resources internal to its borders and through its borders, and it should tap into local resources and get the maximum value out of them, whether they're human resources, capital resources, natural resources. And when you look at that, you think, well, what do we have as a city in terms of natural resources? Well, sun that falls, rain, you know, that falls, you know, on the city. We have waste, and we can minimize the waste, but we are going to have solid waste. And if we can recycle that and then build in small-scale scrap manufacturing, and by the way, scrap manufacturing is always smaller scale than virgin material manufacturing, then you can begin to think of the city in a different way. That was 1974. In about 10, 15 years ago, 2002, 2003, we added to the specific sectors that we focus on telecommunications. And we have been working with cities for them to build their own fiber networks. You know, cities own the roads, they own the water pipes, and nobody seems to call those socialist systems, right? And they're infrastructure, and they make sense to be essential physical infrastructure. And fiber networks are now essential infrastructure. And we're also learning that essentially your cable company and your telephone company are monopolies. They are unresponsive. And since they are making out like bandits with essentially a distribution system that was paid off 20 years ago, they'll upgrade, but they're going to upgrade very slowly and mostly in protest. And so we've been working with cities, and there are now almost 500 cities that have fiber networks, partial, and over 100 cities that have citywide fiber networks, and they compete. With the cable companies and with the telephone companies, and they compete very successfully. So we have been, you know, trying to preach to cities that even the physical infrastructure is very important. And the thing is that if a city owns its own broadband network, it doesn't have to worry much about things like net neutrality or the digital divide. It is in charge of the rules of the road. So if this, and it's the government closest to the people. So if the people want a certain kind of rule, they can make it happen without having to go to the Federal Communications Commission and then go to court and then try to get Comcast not to take over your state legislature and preempt your authority from doing it. There are 17 states right now that, because their cities were successful at building their own municipal networks, have preempted the right of new cities from doing it.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, you've been talking a lot about cities. Is that the focus, or do you also work with counties, or, you know, more like rural areas like we are here in West Marin? Is that also part of it, or is it primarily cities?
No, it's cities and it's counties. It's rural areas, but we tend to focus on a place that has a government structure that can be useful.
Right.
So it wouldn't be necessarily a region.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a county. Once again, when it comes to municipal broadband, the most interesting things that are going on right now are in rural areas, and in rural areas almost entirely the fiber networks are owned by the cooperative electric companies or the cooperative telephone companies.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for people who are interested in the history of politics, the New Deal, one of the things that it created was the Rural Electrification Program,
right,
in which it gave 50-year financing for people to essentially build their own electric systems, and people owned those electric systems. They had to give $10, and then they became a member of it. So they owned them, and in the late 1940s, they expanded that to telephone. So there are a lot of telephone cooperatives and mom-and-pop mm-hmm. telephone companies, and there are a lot of rural electric utilities, and both of them tend to be the prime movers mm-hmm. In putting in fiber. We also look at states, and, you know, we are at a moment now, because of this federal government, where the only thing left is a few blue states and a lot of blue cities in red states that would like to preempt the authority of blue cities from doing anything. So we are at a moment here where the fight is both defensive but can also be proactive. And so the states become a real key. The courts have decided that cities are a mere creature of the states, and states can do anything that they want, essentially, to a city, including in most states abolishing a city if it decides to do that.
Oh, really?
So that, because cities are not mentioned in the Constitution, you know, the municipal corporation is not mentioned in the Constitution, and the private corporation is not mentioned in the Constitution. Well, the Supreme Court has decided that because the municipal corporation is not mentioned in the Constitution, it has no authority, and the state can do anything it wants. It's a mere creature of the state. It also decided that because the private corporation is not mentioned in the Constitution, it's a person, and it has complete authority as if it were a human being.
That's kind of odd,
uh-huh.
you might say.
Mm-hmm, right.
Now, you know, I'm just thinking about the name of your organization, Institute for Local Self-Reliance. When you created it, obviously, as you mentioned, the 70s, things were different. And when you think of self-reliance now and 2017, and that's why I think, you know, your focus on fiber networks is sort of, you know, in a way shows like sort of the evolution of the thinking. But did you ever envision what that concept, have you sort of reinterpreted what local self-reliance means over time, or has your concept sort of been pretty steady, or does it keep kind of changing with the times? I'm just curious.
No, I think it's been pretty steady. I mean, when we kind of perceived the future in the late 1970s, early 1980s, we perceived the idea of sort of personal computers and cities inventing new ways of doing things and then exporting them via what, you know, became the web,
right.
You know, sort of a horizontal transfer mm-hmm. of information and innovation. And we work with the independent businesses a great deal. We've set up We've set up maybe over 100 local independent business associations in the country. And about 5 years ago, we set up an association of trade associations of independent businesses. So the independent retail pharmacies and retail hardware stores and bookstores, you know, and the like have sort of come together in trade associations. And then this is a kind of a trade association of trade associations. And so we've set them up, and what they are is an alternative chamber of commerce. Now, almost all of them are members of the Chamber of Commerce, and so their interests overlap. But at the same time, they have a distinct interest in warding off the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world, whereas the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world are part of the Chamber of Commerce, and all they care about is no regulation and no taxes. So they are on a parallel structure with the Chamber of Commerce, and sometimes they oppose them. For example, in New York State, which was the first state to impose a sales tax on Amazon, it was the independent business associations that went to Albany and said, those other business associations that have been talking to you don't represent all businesses. We represent 90% of businesses. And that was very useful in getting it through.
Sure. Now, in terms of the breadth, we've talked about, fiber and sort of phone. We haven't talked too much about energy, but I tend to talk about energy a lot on my show anyhow. So, but what else, what other kinds of, I think you're involved with food issues perhaps, or maybe not, but kind of give a broader sense of how broad do you take this concept of self-reliance?
Well, we take the concept quite broadly. Food, where we were involved at the beginning, that is something that actually evolved. We were involved with neighborhood gardens. We were involved in urban food production. One of the things in Washington, D.C., where we were born, is that they have a height limitation. And so if you look down from the sky, you see a whole bunch of flat roofs about 10 stories up, which is good for solar, but is also good for greenhouses. So we looked at that, but then we realized that essentially food production is not an urban concept. Right. But we did look at, we have worked with farmers on value added in terms of food production. But broadly, we're interested in things like expanding the commons, expanding the things that we own in common. Philadelphia, about, I think, last 6 months ago, 9 months ago, Philadelphia passed a soda tax. Now, it's 1.5 cents per ounce. Now, think of that. Okay, 1.5 cents an ounce is a hefty tax. You know, if you got a 16-ounce, that's a hefty tax, right? 1.5 cents per ounce, it's raising about $90 million a year, and it's specifically dedicated to expanding the commons, which means libraries, rec centers, parks, and pre-K, essentially pre-kindergarten universal education. So that's a dramatically interesting way forward. And it's a city that did that. You have in San Antonio, there was a referendum, and the people taxed themselves a sales tax, a broad sales tax, to raise $30 million a year for universal pre-K. There are 40 states that have pre-K financing programs, no more than 9 cover more than 50%, and San Antonio will be 100%. So it's broad in the sense that there are things that we share, whether it's kids, a public school system, a public park, a public recreation center, and we want to expand that into a publicly owned fiber network, a publicly owned solar facility. Take your sewage plant and make it a natural gas plant as well. Take your food, food wastes and organic wastes, and make them into compost, and then at the same time get some gas out of that as well. So essentially using our ingenuity to tap into our kind of native ingenuity. And when we develop something that is useful to other cities and other either here or abroad, we share it with them. And so the nice thing about the city networks is that it is international.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. But most of your members are in the U.S., I assume, or no, maybe not.
Yes, most of our members are in the U.S. We've worked in Latin America. We've mm-hmm. worked in, in Europe, but most are in the United States. There are a few federalist systems in the world. Germany, for example, has a similar federal system than we do. But in a lot of the developing countries, cities are enormous.
Right.
And so people have been pouring off of the farm in a very much quicker than they ever did in the United States. And so you have cities of 10 million, 20 million, even 30 million people. And we don't know what to do with a scale that's that large.
Sure.
So we don't even New York City to us is too large to think of as a city. On the other hand, it's broken up into boroughs. I grew up in Queens. Queens itself has neighborhoods. So you can in fact parcel it out mm-hmm. and think of Queens. You know, Brooklyn was the third largest, has a little sign, I think it still does, when you come into Brooklyn, you're entering the third largest city in the United States, which it was.
Right.
And an interesting story about Brooklyn is that Manhattan wanted to take over Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And they had three referendums on whether they wanted to be taken over. And they lost the first two, and then they built the Brooklyn Bridge. And in 1898, the same year that the United States took over the Philippines and Hawaii and Puerto Rico, Manhattan took over Brooklyn.
That's a good historical context there.